suggest to you that perhaps the marketplace in this case is the best place for those kinds of decisions to be made. The second argument I heard was, well, no other state's license, but California repealed it and now it's coming back, and Washington State looks like it's coming back as well. I'd like to suggest to you that perhaps the reason for that is that they did, as Oregon seems to have done, and hired a registered lobbyist to do the job for them. The third argument I heard was there was nowhere else before 73 when the board came into existence for consumers to go with consumer complaints. That's not true. There's a place called the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's Office right over the way there that does, in my opinion, a terrific job answering consumer complaints. Not only do they do a good job, they have the law enforcement tools that are necessary to make sure that consumers get a fair shake. I'd like to suggest to you that this would be a great opportunity to promote more efficiency in government, do away with this board, and put the functions of the board over in the Attorney General's office. In other words, make it known to the consumers of Oregon that if they have a consumer complaint about tax examiners, they go to the Consumer Protection Division of the AG's office. The fourth argument I heard is that all other professions are licensed from masseurs on down, and why shouldn't we be? And I guess I don't even feel that needs answering, but I would like to bring that up. All in all, I'd like to suggest to you very strongly that the public health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of Oregon would not be greatly endangered if this board were allowed to be sunsetted. And I would respectfully request you all to seriously think about that. Thank you.
Any questions, committee members?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Otto.
The Attorney General has already prepared his budget, I assume, for submission to the Assembly. And this obviously would not be in his budget. I guess the question is this. After we go ahead and transfer the enforcement of the violation of the Ethics Commission laws to the Attorney General, are we going to be overburdening the Attorney General with this additional caseload?
I have a note here, Pam, the same question.
I think, you know, I do know that the Consumer Protection Division of the Attorney General's office is understaffed and underfunded, as is every state agency, I'm sure. I do think, though, that all of these boards and commissions need to be looked at in a broader perspective. I know that we're hearing tax service examiners this afternoon. I don't want to stray too far off base. But I do want to suggest to you that there is a Consumer Protection Division, and I don't think enough citizens of the state of Oregon know that it exists and understand what a good job it's doing. I suspect down the road that if, you know, in some never-never land, all of these consumer complaints that some of these boards and commissions take care of now were transferred over there, they would probably need some extra help. But I also think that there would be economies of scale that would benefit from that. I think that having it all in one central location would be a major benefit to Oregon consumers, because there'd be one place to call. You wouldn't have to be shifted around to two or three different places. I think that would be a real benefit, and I think they do
one
a good job
question.
Over there.
One other question, Pam. We say that this does not affect the health, life, safety, and welfare, and whatever. I guess if I had some unscrupulous or unknowledgeable tax preparer prepare a tax statement for me and come up with astronomical figure that I owed to the federal government or the state government, and I was under the impression that if I failed to pay, I'd be thrown in jail and all these other horrible things. And I did pay. Then I found out later that that was not the case, that an error had been made. Sure, I could go to the Consumer Protection Division and file a complaint, and I've been there, not on my own, but on behalf of other people, and I find it's a long, drawn-out process pretty much of the time. And that's disturbing to me. Now, granted, just because a person holds a license or a certificate doesn't mean that that person is competent. But I would think that that person would be more competent after having taken some courses and at least taken the examination and all. I think that person would probably be more competent than a lot of other people out there that would think to themselves, well, I've taken a course at the community college and now I'm a tax preparer. I'll hang out my shingle and I'll make a few bucks because it's prior to April 15th. I collect some dollars and then I take off and go down the street or down into the valley and someone's trying to find me. And I've created many errors on these tax returns, and I don't think that the consuming public out there really has adequate recourse, even if they do go to the Attorney General's office.
Well,
would you respond?
Yeah, I have a couple responses to that. First of all, I heard here this afternoon, which I guess was a little surprise to me, is that a number of these people are already bonded and have insurance. Mm-hmm. So that it seems to me that even if they weren't licensed, suppose they were, for example, simply registered, which I guess, you know, barring anything, I would prefer that, you would know where they were. You as a consumer, if there were any dollar recourse down the road, I would imagine would be able to obtain it that way. I do appreciate your comment that it's a slow procedure over in the Consumer Protection Division. I might suggest that if you registered tax service examiners, you could take the registration fees. I mean, I don't know technically how these things work, but maybe you could take the fees and add it to the Attorney General's budget so that he would have the staff to, you know, to hurry things along over there. And I appreciate that, and I think it's very frustrating on the part of a consumer to have to go through all of that red tape and weeks and sometimes months of waiting to get your complaint resolved. And I think maybe there are things that can be done about that. And I guess the third thing about the fact that taking a test does or doesn't certify that you do or don't know anything. I taught at OSU, and I had students, freshmen in my classes, that high schools graduated and certified that they could read. And boy, I'll tell you, you know, some of them couldn't. And so I think the literature also, the academic literature that's been written on the relationship between professional testing and professional competence clearly shows that there is no way to directly establish a relationship, and I think that's kind of interesting. So
I guess my parting shot at you, and I'm not taking shots.
I know.
I guess my parting comment is that I work at the electrical trade, and I know a lot of people out there, probably everyone in this room, could go ahead and get the little manual from Sears and Roebuck or one of the discount houses that sell electrical equipment, and go ahead and, yes, I'll wire this, and the switch works the light, and the end result is that the light works, and the outlet receptacle works, and now they're qualified as an electrician. And they go out, and they look for ways to increase their income, and they do what is known as moonlighting. And oftentimes, the moonlight lighting results in a fire.
Sure.
And those people aren't responsible. They could say, well, you gave me a few dollars to do this, but I'm sorry that your house burnt down.
Sure. Could I just...
Well, if the chairman lets you, I don't know.
If you want to tell me about an electrical fire you had, no. We're going to talk about this bill, yes.
Well, I don't mean to imply that all licensing is wrong. Obviously, electricians need to be licensed because people's lives are in danger. But I do think, seriously, that there's a kind of a spectrum of what you mean by the public health, safety, and welfare. I think clearly when lives are in danger, some sort of standard is in order.
Well, if I pay a sizable sum more than what I should on my income tax, my welfare is going to be jeopardized. I'm sorry.
Well,
Thank you, Pam.
I won't say anything.
I'd like to.
Thank you.
Oh. Yes, ma'am.
Pam?
There's another electrician down here, I must tell you.
That's right.
One of the things that I got from your testimony, Pam, that I'd like to respond to, maybe a frustration I share with you. We live in a very complicated society, and I think that we don't have the expertise in all facets of that society. Certainly, it's been an eye-opening experience for me to go through these different boards and commissions that I didn't even know existed, certainly, and I have no idea, except from what the testimony and the actions of the committee, what they do. I think if you transferred all authority to the Attorney General's office, you could have an electrical question where a consumer came in and thinks that they were cheated on an electrical job or their taxes. And the question is, who would have the expertise in the Attorney General's office to really know if there, in fact there was a fraudulent case there? These boards are set up of people's peers, and they self-regulate themselves. So they certainly do, because they know what is right and what's wrong. One other thing, and it's a bill I'll be introducing later on, not to this committee, but something that is very much related. When you have licensing, you have a very good power. You have the right to revoke that license and then, in effect, either suspend or revoke that license, and you take that fraudulent individual out of commission for a while. When you have registration, he can go out and simply say he's defrauded someone of money on an income tax. He can go out and then set up another business. What's he out? He's not out anything. He can just continue to pull this stuff. And it's unfortunate, but we've got to have some rules somewhere. That's all I want to say.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Campbell.
I think philosophically, if I had my way, we would eliminate all boards and commissions, philosophically. But the industries, I think, have a responsibility for regulating themselves. Unfortunately, there are many industries who will not regulate themselves unless there is a structure to do so. Now the question is to whether or not that structure belongs under their own control, mm-hmm. or whether it belongs in the Consumer Protection Office or the Attorney General's office or wherever it might be, becomes a question that the legislature has to deal with, because I think the decision's already been made for us that there are many that will not regulate themselves or take care of their own needs. Having boards and commissions, from my standpoint, gives them responsibility for their own actions, but it doesn't limit it to that. You can still take a tax preparer to court on criminal charges. You can still, in other words, you still have the right as an individual. Now the question we get to, Pam, is how we pay for the regulation. And again, you have to recognize that I would love to forget the right. I say that 90% of the regulation we have boards and commission is turf regulation, okay? And that's the thing we're dealing with all the time. In other words, I don't want you in my business, I don't want you in my business, I don't want you to take my business, that kind of thing. That's one of the reasons why folks are so interested in being regulated. But see, my view of why they have to be regulated is considerably different than that. I wouldn't support the continuation of a board and commission in order to protect their turf. But now let's talk about how we finance it. You've used the Attorney General, and I wrote you a note before Representative Otto made his comments about the Ethics Commission and the Attorney General. But if we were not to have them pay for their own regulation, it means that we would have to come up with a means of paying for that regulation. And you can see we're already underfinancing the Consumer Protection Division. We don't have the money today to do that. They're willing to pay for their own regulation, and they're willing to put that in statute so that there are some basic parameters and controls on what they do. I think you make a good point. I just think that maybe you're a ways ahead of yourself or ahead of the system.
Mm-hmm. Could I just briefly respond?
You're going to anyway, whether he allows you to.
Well, I did want to make clear, I don't think that tax service examiners are paying for the regulation. It's the consumers of Oregon who buy their services who are paying. I think that's very clear. That was all I wanted to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to speak on this bill? Thank you all for coming and for your interest. And the hearing is closed on House Bill 2093. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will hear House Bill 2105. Dealing with utilities.
This meeting will adjourn.
We are now going to commence a hearing on House Bill 2105. Is Lou McKenna here?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lou McCann. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Commerce. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2105. This is a bill that was submitted at the request of the Department of Commerce to try to correct a inconsistency, or at least a problem, in the department carrying out its responsibilities. In 1979, the legislature passed a law that required the director, when petitioned, to establish rates for hooking on to poles that were the property of public utility districts. An example here would be when a cable company wants to run its lines through a geographical area that's occupied by public utility district, the parties are encouraged to set a fee for the rental of those pole facilities that's fair, just, and equitable. When the parties can't agree on that amount, under the relevant statutes, they're entitled to petition the director of the Department of Commerce to establish those rates. Accordingly, a hearing would be held. Initially, rules would have to be developed and a hearing held. Up to this point, we have absolutely no experience with this because there has been no petition submitted until just recently, and accordingly, that's forced the question. We do not have any provision under this act to charge the parties for the hearing, nor does the department have any other funding source available to it that would be appropriate to pay for the costs of the hearing. Therefore, we submitted House Bill 2105 that would essentially allow the director to pass on the costs of conducting the hearing to the concerned parties. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Committee members? Mm-hmm. Representative Otto?
You're with Department of Commerce.
Yes, sir.
I read over the bill, and I guess my question was, if it's a good idea for the Department of Commerce, why not include the PUC?
At the time that we discovered this particular problem, we did think of the same question, and contacted the Public Utility Commission, and they had indicated that they had authority through other statutes, which I have not researched, that allowed them to conduct any hearings that that they might be required to hold. I further understand that at least up to this point, they've not been requested to conduct any hearing for the investor-owned utility companies. But that's as far as I went with that. They were invited to participate, and they said that they did not have the need.
Well, if I may, Mr.
Yes, Chair. Just continue.
In 1979. I think the investor-owned utilities come before this, not this committee, come before Intergovernmental Affairs about joint use of poles. And it seems as though the Lincoln County PUD was charging, I may be wrong, but it seems to me they were charging an excessive amount or at least in the eyes of some people, charging an excessive amount for the use of their pole to attach a cable TV line to it. And that was the original basis for the bill. And then it went, was put under the PUC. One other question. I know that you can't give me a definite answer, but how many bucks are we talking about?
In terms of conducting a hearing?
Yes, and rendering a decision. In other words, how many dollars are we talking about? Are we talking hundreds, thousands? What?
I think probably you're correct in saying that these costs have been estimated, and I'm not sure how precise the estimate is, but the department did prepare a fiscal impact statement on the bill that could not attempt to determine how many hearings there might be, but did attempt to indicate what the cost of one hearing would be. And we did this on the basis of very limited experience through the boards that exist within the Department of Commerce when they conduct contested case hearings. And then once we generated those figures, we ran them by the PUC, who has much more extensive experience at rate-setting type of hearings. And the cost that we came up with was $4,400 for one hearing. And this would include the costs of having a contract hearings officer actually sit and hear the testimony, the clerical preparation time and preparing of the documents, advice and counsel of the Attorney General. And the $4,400 figure I just gave you would be, it would assume worst case. In other words, it would assume that the outcome was subject to appeal and accordingly was taken to the Court of Appeals. Without that, the cost would probably be half that amount or something in excess of $2,000. That's about the best that we could come up with on the experience and information that we've had available to us.
Glenn's asking questions right now.
Okay, are you still asking questions, Representative?
I'm in a holding pattern. Well, I guess my question is, you averaged it out about $4,000 per hearing. Some could go much higher and some could go conceivably lower. Okay.
Representative Skinner.
Lou, why doesn't the Public Utilities Commissioner regulate all of this? Why is the Department of Commerce involved in it at all?
Sir, I'm sure there are people that have a lot better history behind the initial legislative intent than I do, since I wasn't associated with the department at the time of this legislation. But I understand that there is this basic split between the public utility districts, which are essentially operated by, you know, the local board of directors, as opposed to the investor-owned utilities. And, of course, those utilities are subject to the total regulation by the Public Utility Commissioner. As I understand it, the PUDs are not. And so I can only presume that at the time there was a need to begin some type of or have some process of appeal on setting fair rates, that those folks didn't particularly want it to be done by the Public Utility Commissioner.
Is that the way you split the responsibilities and determine who would have the hearing?
The existing law pretty much specifies that if there is a rate argument between a cable company and a investor-owned utility, that would go to the Public Utility Commissioner, and in the case of PUDs, they would go to the Department of Commerce.
You handle the co-ops also?
I believe the definition of the statute includes co-ops as PUDs.
Is there any further questions, this gentleman?
I have one more.
Representative Otto.
Approximately how many cases per year are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, we have absolutely no idea. I've been able to determine that there's something like 30 to I believe it's 30 to 34 public utility districts that would be subject to having a rate dispute, if you will. How many of them, like I said, since 1979, we've never had any. Now we have one that's pending. And so how many, you know, whether this is the first of many or whether perhaps this one will establish some reasonable basis for those cable companies out there to reflect against, I don't know.
One other question.
All
right. If we were to pass this bill, would this maybe eliminate the request for, I guess, would it help solve a problem out there? People knowing that they'd have to pay, would they be more hesitant to file a complaint or something establishing rates, you think?
I'm not sure I could even speculate on that. It would only be speculation. I think if you don't pass this bill, the problem that the Department of Commerce would have would either be to decline to participate in conducting a hearing for lack of budget, or I suppose another option would be to go to the emergency board to seek funds from the general fund. I believe the activities in the Department of Commerce, which are pretty much dedicated to specific purposes, we would probably run into audit conflicts if we attempted to spend those funds for this purpose. So I think this bill was submitted, I think, to try to take care of a situation that's going to be coming right at us. It's at hand right now. I think it would take care of an audit and an administrative problem. The impact on the industry out there, I can't project that.
Any further questions, Representative?
Yeah. How are you financing these hearings now? I mean, you have them, obviously.
No, sir, we don't. We have not since the passage of the original legislation that gave us the responsibility to conduct them. If we were petitioned, we have never been petitioned. I think it's about a month ago, we did receive the first request to intervene and to conduct a hearing.
Then, to the best of your knowledge, the PUC has handled all the other complaints?
Yeah, question. They're not really complaints. They're disputes in the rental rate, if you will, of what I would charge you to string your cable on my telephone pole, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And where the two parties can't agree on that rate, then if it happens to be a pole owned by a public utility district, they would approach the Director of Commerce through a petition for rate setting, and we've received one of those just recently. The Public Utility Commissioner has received none to date. So that's why it makes it a little bit difficult to forecast how many we're going to have or what the actual costs will be. But structurally, I'm only saying in this bill that if we don't have this authority, we have a problem in carrying out the law, irrespective of how many there would be.
Mr. Chairman, one more.
Yes, Mr. Representative.
Thank you. What was the legislation that granted you the authority to be able to do this?
I believe it was Senate Bill 560 passed in the... Yeah, as it turns out, it was ORS 757.276 is the citation.
When was that passed?
The 1979 session of the legislature.
Thank you.
Would you repeat that ORS, please?
Yes, ORS 757.276.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Lou.
Yes, sir.
Austin Collins.
Mr. Chairman, compatriot, and committee members, my name is Austin Collins, and my address is on record. I am a registered independent lobbyist, a public advocate. And this bill is, well, it beggars description, in my opinion. And I would like to say that I'm quite disappointed that Representative Campbell is not present. And I'm also disappointed that there is not a better defense of the bill as filed. If I'm correct, I believe that my predecessor witness here was a state employee. Is that true? Okay, thank you. First, this bill appears or allows unwarranted...
If you want a better clarification, he's Deputy Director of the Department of Commerce.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Now, I'll speak directly to the bill quickly. There's another brush fire going out upstairs in 3354. This allows unwarranted authority to the discretion of one individual and appointed officer of the government. And two, do we have an Attorney General's opinion statement on the constitutionality of ORS 757-279? This referring back to line 4 in the bill, printed bill. And three, in respect to line 6 and 7,